Welcome to our paranormal afterlife. This is episode 227 of Paranormal Stories. In this episode, I'm reading from Michelle Brooks' book, Proof Beyond the Grave: Real Accounts, Real Memories, Real Continuation. When I have guests on my podcasts, I read their books to work out questions for the episodes. And when reading these books, I always find such amazing information that never makes it into the podcast. And here, I get a chance to give you a peek into the book. I've put a link to the book in the show notes, and I did seek permission to record this extract, and the author kindly said yes. I'm going to be reading from chapter 2, which is titled The Child Who Knew Too Much: Early Indicators of Lives Remembered. The onset of recall, when the whispers begin. There is a particular kind of silence that falls over a room when a three-year-old child, in the middle of playing with a wooden toy, turns to their mother and says, with perfect calm, "That is not my real home. I have a wife. I died on the road to Kanpur." The silence is not disbelief. It is the sound of a worldview cracking. This is how it begins, not with drama, not with fanfare, but with the innocent, matter-of-fact certainty of a child who does not yet understand why what they are saying should be impossible. The onset of past life recall is, in the vast majority of documented cases, quiet, incremental, woven into the fabric of ordinary days. A child points to a photograph of strangers and calls one of them by a name. A child describes a house in a city they have never visited, sketching the layout of its rooms with their fingers in the air. A child weeps with a grief that seems far older than their years. Dr. Ian Stevenson, whose 4 decades of fieldwork at the University of Virginia's Division of Perceptual Studies produced the most comprehensive academic database of such cases in the world, identified a consistent developmental window for these memories. The overwhelming majority of children who report past life recall do so between the ages of 2 and 5. This is not coincidental. This window precedes the formal socialization of school, the absorption of cultural narratives, the accumulated influence of media. A child of 2 or 3 years old has not yet had the opportunity to construct a sophisticated deception. Their world is still largely built from sensation, emotion, and immediate family, and yet it is precisely within this narrow, tender window that the memories tend to be freshest, most detailed, most verifiable. The manner in which these memories emerge is as important as the memories themselves. Researchers place enormous weight on spontaneity. A child who volunteers information unprompted, who interrupts a meal to describe the street where they used to live, who corrects a family member's geography with quiet confidence, carries far more evidential weight than a child whose statements emerge in response to leading questions or family suggestion. In the strongest documented cases, the parents were not only unaware of the previous personality whose life the child was describing, but were sometimes actively resistant to the idea that their child might be recalling anything more than fantasy. As these memories surface, they are rarely limited to words alone. Children express them through play, assembling toy figures into scenes that mirror events from a life not their own. They express them through emotion, displaying a longing or grief for people that they have never met that strikes those around them as disproportionate, uncanny, and real. They express them through behaviour, exhibiting fears and preferences that seem to have no origin in the life they are currently living. And occasionally, most remarkably of all, they express them through their bodies, bearing upon their skin the physical marks of wounds that ended another life before theirs began. The child who begins to speak of a life not their own is not performing. They are reporting. And what they report, in the strongest cases, is demonstrably, verifiably true. The window is finite. As children grow older, the memories tend to fade. They are gradually submerged beneath the accumulating weight of current experience, of school and friendship, and the construction of a new identity. Most children stop speaking of their past lives entirely by the age of 7 or 8. This gradual fading is itself significant. It mirrors no known pattern of imagination or fabrication. Children who invent stories do not typically abandon them as they mature, but children who remember appear to forget, as if distance from the crossing grows with each year of living. Verifiable details, names, places, and relationships. What separates a compelling case from mere childhood fancy is not the drama of the claim, but the precision of the detail. Any child can say they were someone else once. What they cannot do, without access to knowledge beyond their years and circumstances, is name that person's family, describe their home, recount the cause of their death, and lead strangers to a house in a city they have never visited, navigating its streets without assistance. This is precisely what Shanti Devi did. Born in Delhi, India, on December 11, 1926, Shanti began speaking of a past life around the age of 4. She told her parents she was not from Delhi. Her real home, she insisted, was in Mathura, a city roughly 145 kilometers away. She described a husband, a fabric merchant, whose name she refused to reveal for years, following the traditional Indian custom that wives do not speak their husband's name aloud. She said she had died 10 days after giving birth to a son. She used words from Mathura dialect that no one in the Delhi household recognized. When her school headmaster finally coaxed the name from her, she whispered it, Pandit Kandanath Chalbi of 9 Chalbi Street, Mathura. The headmaster wrote to that address. He received a reply. There was indeed a fabric merchant named Kandanath Chalbi in Mathura. His wife, Lugdi Devi, had died in October 1925 from complications following childbirth, approximately 14 months before Shanti Devi was born. Kedarnath travelled to Delhi under a false name, introduced as his own elder brother, to test the girl. Shanti Devi recognised him immediately. She wept when she saw his son, Navneet Nal, the child she claimed to have died bringing into the world. She told her mother he was fair-skinned, wore reading glasses, and had a wart on his left cheek. All of it was true. The case captured the attention of Mahatma Gandhi, who established a formal committee of 15 prominent investigators, including parliamentarians, journalists, and national leaders. On November 24, 1935, the committee travelled with Shanti Devi to Mathura by rail. As the train approached the city, she became flushed with excitement, remarking that by the time they arrived, the doors of the Dwarkadish temple would be closed for the evening. They were. At the station, she recognised Kendanath's elder brother in the crowd, unprompted, touched his feet in the traditional gesture of respect, and named him correctly. She navigated the streets of Mathura to her former home without guidance. She located her bedroom. She identified dialect words known only to the Chalbi community of Mathura. She led investigators to a spot on the second floor where she said she had hidden money. The spot was empty, but Kendanath later confessed he had removed the cash after his wife's death. Birthmarks as echoes, the physical connection. Of all the evidence gathered in 4 decades of reincarnation research, perhaps nothing is more difficult to dismiss than what is written on the body. Birthmarks are present from the moment of birth. They predate language, they predate memory, they predate any opportunity for suggestion, coaching, or cultural transmission. And in more than 200 documented cases examined by Ian Stevenson in his landmark 1997 two-volume work, Reincarnation and Biology, a contribution to the etiology of birthmarks and birth defects, published by Prager Publishers, they correspond with extraordinary precision to the fatal or significant wounds of the deceased individuals those children claim to remember. Stevenson spent 30 years assembling these cases. He photographed the marks. He obtained medical records and autopsy reports. He measured the correspondence between what was on the child's body and what the documents said had happened to the previous personality. He was not satisfied with approximate matches. He looked for cases where the location, shape, size, and character of the mark could be compared directly to documented evidence of a specific wound. What he found, in case after documented case, challenged the most basic assumptions of how bodies and identities are formed. Among the cases Stevenson published is that of a boy born with two distinctive birthmarks on his body, one small, round, and regular on his chest, the other irregular and ragged on his back. The boy claimed to remember the life of a man who had been shot. The location of the front mark corresponded to an entry wound, the location of the back mark corresponding to an exit wound. When investigators obtained the autopsy report for the man the boy claimed to have been, the wounds documented in that report matched the birthmarks with a precision that Stevenson described as, in his professional judgment, beyond coincidence. Today I was reading from Michelle Brooks' book, Proof Beyond the Grave, Real Accounts, Real Memories, Real Continuation. And if you want to buy the book, there is info and a link in the show notes. And my book on verified near-death experiences is out now on Amazon, and you can get it on paperback, audiobook, or Kindle. And if you enjoy the podcast, please leave a review and be sure to subscribe on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or via your favourite podcast app to make sure that you don't miss out on any episodes. And thanks for listening.